Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from our studios in central London. I'm Julian Marshall, and later in the programme we'll bring you more on those reports that Donald Trump is safe after gunshots were fired in his vicinity at his golf course in Florida. We understand the media are to be briefed by the police shortly. We'll bring you the latest when we know more. But first, Donald Trump and his vice presidential running mate, J.D. Vance, have doubled down on their false claims that Haitian immigrants in the town of Springfield, Ohio, have been eating cats and dogs. And that's despite the fact that the claims have been widely debunked and ridiculed. Social media has been flooded with amusing memes and reactions. Digital creators and musicians have come up not just with memes, but parody songs, like this one called Eating the Cats.
They're eating the dogs. They're eating the cats. They're eating the pets of the people that live there.
People of Springfield, please don't eat my cats. Why would you do that? Eat something else.
Well, that was by the musician David Scott, also known as the Kiffner, surfer slang for cool, who's based in Cape Town, South Africa.
My aim with this particular song is to bring levity to a heated topic and, you know, unite people around a common cause. And in this case, the cause was to raise money for the animals in Ohio. So any money that we make from the song on YouTube or Spotify is going to be donated to the SPCA in Springfield, Ohio.
I mean, you speak about levity, David, but in a way, do you not feel that's kind of undermining the gravity of what Mr. Trump said? Or do you think it was just so ridiculous?
I just saw the absurdity and the ridiculousness of the comment, and it just so happened to make a humorous song. I'm not taking away from the seriousness of the situation. And I think there is something to be said about using humor and satire to highlight the questionable decisions or statements of authority figures. But I don't think that's my role. I think I ultimately believe that my role in society is to use my God-given talent, which is music, to just bring joy and light. And if that means taking a clip of Donald Trump saying a ridiculous thing, I think I'm going to do that. Everyone loves music. Everyone loves dogs and cats. And I think the words that Trump used just so happened to be hilarious and, you know, made for a great song, like I said. But even people who dislike Trump have been telling me that the song is an earworm and they can't get it out their heads.
South African musician David Scott. Well, Donald Trump has refused to drop the claim. Here he is speaking to a rally on Thursday night in Tucson, Arizona.
They're taking the geese. You know, where the geese are in the park, in the lake, and even walking off with their pets.
And today, Donald Trump's running mate, J.D. Vance, who was actually the first to make the allegation, raised the issue again with the U.S. network CNN. He appeared to acknowledge the claims were not true. He said, yes, we created the actual focus that allowed the American media to talk about this story. He said the American media had totally ignored the problems facing people in Springfield until he and Donald Trump started talking about cat memes. If I have to create stories so that the American media actually pays attention, he said, to the suffering of the American people, then that's what I'm going to do. Well, for the residents of Springfield, the claims are all becoming something of a nightmare. The town's mayor, Rob Rue, spoke to this programme yesterday.
It's just disheartening to have some of this negative press and some of these false rumors spread about us. You know, there's been bomb threats to our community in the last couple of days. We've had schools closed down, city buildings closed down. We've had to check different properties with email threats that we're receiving. We need help, not hate, in Springfield, Ohio.
So what's been the fallout from Mr. Trump and Mr. Vance's false claims on Haitian immigrants in Springfield, Ohio? Philomène Philoustin is a Haitian-American business owner in the town.
It's kind of like every day. For instance, last night was in my church. Some white folk come in and they was speak kind of like a little nasty toward everything like that. So we have to call 911. And it's kind of like they're looking what now, any little thing. If one Haitian have little issues or whatever, even you driving or any little thing, they just grab a phone, make a video and talk about it. It's kind of a little scary for some people. And even in my church this morning, we usually have a lot of people in the church. We can see like we don't have much people we usually have.
And are these white people residents of Springfield or do they come from outside?
We don't really know. If you see somebody on the street, they don't identify themselves to see exactly where, who they are. So you will not know. So you see them and they live here. You see them on the street or you see them anywhere.
So it's difficult for Haitians.
It is very difficult for Haitians right now. I think we're living in fear. We're really living in fear. Even last night, I've been followed last night. I don't know who was following me. It's kind of like little crazy kids today. I'm a pastor for the youth, and I usually have over 72, 65, 70 kids. This morning, I only have 50-something kids. And you can hear the kids talking about, like, when they go into the school, the teacher have to lock their phone. They ask me if something happened, how they're going to contact the parents. They have a lot of fear. The people build Springfield. The Haitian people build Springfield. After we do all those work, they build Springfield. And now we don't deserve to stay here. After all money we spent, all the energy, and then we are hard worker. So it's kind of like a little stress and kind of a little strange.
I mean, how were relations between the Haitians in Springfield and the white residents before Donald Trump and J.D. Vance said these things about pet cats and dogs?
Well, I can say, you know, we have some incident was happened. The guy was driving the bus and we was hurt. And then before that, we was fine. They never attack us, really, until Mr. Trump has proclaimed all those false thing about the Haitian eating a cat or dog and then whatever proclamation he made. Since then, people here don't live with peace.
So what's your message to Donald Trump and J.D. Vance?
Okay, we are human beings and we have a blood. We suppose even somebody believe in or not believe in the Bible, we are brothers and sisters. We belong to us, one king. And we here in Springfield, people work hard. We love as family. We work. We do everything we have to do. And we build the Springfield. And I would like to tell Mr. Trump, please, if he can leave the immigrant people some kind of peace to live, to raise the kids. And myself, I'm a U.S. citizen. All my kids can vote here. We don't have a small child. And then other people, they are U.S. citizen too. So I would like to tell Mr. Trump, we here to work. We left our country because situation of the security. So please stop saying things he don't know.
That was Philomène Philoustin, a Haitian-American business owner in Springfield, Ohio. And on the line now, Julia Manchester, reporter with The Hill, based in Washington, D.C. Good to have you with us, Julia. And since we booked you to come on to talk about Mr. Trump and Springfield, Ohio, we've had these reports of gunshots being fired in Mr. Trump's vicinity at his golf course in Florida. What more can you tell us?
Yeah, I'm actually watching video of the former president's motorcade coming through Palm Beach, coming from Trump International Golf Course to his residence at Mar-a-Lago. So we'll be watching for that. We're also watching for a press conference between U.S. Secret Service and local law enforcement in Palm Beach. But so far, what we know is that according to the Secret Service, around 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, there were shots fired in Trump's vicinity by his golf course, and the former president was on the golf course playing golf at the time. Now, we understand that the Secret Service exchanged fire with this alleged shooter, and someone is apparently in custody. We've heard reports that local law enforcement were able to detain this person. We don't know who this person is. We don't know their, their motivation, their political affiliation, etc. We just know that there was, the shooting that took place.
And that Donald Trump himself is safe, and that the shooting, the violence, has been condemned by the Vice President Kamala Harris.
That's correct. So essentially around, I think it was, 2:15, 2:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Donald Trump's campaign came out with a very short, brief statement saying that he was safe following a shooting in his vicinity. And then Kamala Harris, the vice president, who is also President Trump's political opponent in the upcoming election, released her own statement saying she had been briefed on reports of the shooting and that violence has no place in America. It's remarkable because this obviously comes months after that very close assassination attempt against the former president. Obviously, this is a very different situation, but it comes as the Secret Service is once again under quite a bit of scrutiny over their handling of the former president's secret protection detail.
Okay, Julia, well, let's just turn now to Mr. Trump, Mr. Vance, and Springfield, Ohio. And why are they persisting with these debunked claims? What's in it for them?
You know, that's a good question. I think a lot of us watching the debate, us journalists and even a number of Republicans, would have assumed that this could be a platform where the former president could lay out his strategy to fix what he and many have called the broken immigration system in the U.S. But instead, he really zeroed in on these unfounded, baseless claims that immigrants, particularly Haitian immigrants, are eating pets, which we know is completely untrue. He was fact-checked on this during the debate. But yet he continues to really drill into this unfounded claim, frustrating, I think, a lot of Republicans who would like him to focus more on policy. So it's a big question. I think, listening to it, it seems like he is trying to appeal to his very pro-Trump, ultra-conservative, MAGA base, MAGA obviously meaning Make America Great Again. But there's a lot of questions as to why he would do this. I think immigration has been a tough subject, a tough issue for the Biden administration, including Vice President Harris. So there could be an opportunity for the former president to criticize her handling, the administration's handling of the situation at the southern border in particular. But he seems to be going along with this unfounded claim.
So very briefly, it would seem that he wants to leave the electorate with the thought that immigrants bad.
In this context, yes, I would assume that would be the case, which obviously is not going to, I think, play well for him as he's trying to, and many in the Republican base are trying to expand their base to appeal to immigrants, to appeal to, for example, to Hispanic immigrants.
Julia, look, many thanks for that. That was Julia Manchester, reporter with The Hill, based in Washington, D.C. Coming up, the northern Nigerian town of Maiduguri grapples with an increasing number of internally displaced people affected by flooding.
The state government had set up 4 IDP camps the day after the flooding. By yesterday, there were 27 IDP camps. And yet there's still many other people who, for various reasons, either cannot make it to the IDP camps or decide not to go there for some reason or the other.
and that interview in full later in this edition of NewsHour. The latest headlines from the BBC newsroom: Poland's prime minister says he's going to declare a state of disaster as the country tries to tackle devastating floods that have hit much of eastern and central Europe. We'll have more on that. And 270 prisoners have escaped from a Nigerian jail after the building was damaged by floodwaters. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall, and this is NewsHour. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has warned the Houthis in Yemen they will pay a heavy price after they launched a missile that reached central Israel. The IDF said the weapon landed in an uninhabited area on Sunday morning, but shrapnel indicated air defense systems had failed to destroy it before it entered Israeli airspace. The military is investigating and said the missile most likely fragmented in midair. The Houthis claim they used a new type of hypersonic weapon and that their strikes are in solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza. I've been speaking to Kobe Michael, a senior researcher at the Institute for National Security Studies in Tel Aviv. So was this a hypersonic missile?
It's not hypersonic. This is a sort of very cheap propaganda. This is a regular ballistic missile, an Iranian one, that they used more than once.
How come Israeli air defense systems failed to destroy completely before it entered Israeli airspace?
This is still investigated. Until now, we had very impressive ratio of success, which was 100% of success of the arrow system, okay? The arrow system intercepts the missiles outside the atmosphere. Now, we still don't know what happened. The arrow missile met the missile that was launched by the Houthis, but it didn't succeed in exploding it totally, okay? Only part of it. The missile of the Houthis fell apart to many parts, and these parts fell down on the Israeli soil.
You say that this missile was likely supplied by Iran. So Iran is continuing its fight with Israel through proxies.
Yes, but in the very same time, we have to remember that although the Houthis are considered to be Iranian proxies, they have an agenda of their own. They have a sort of independence, okay? And they have an open account with Israel, and they are very extreme, very radical. But I wouldn't take out of consideration that this missile was launched because the Iranians asked the Houthis to do that, exactly as they asked the other proxies that they operate here in the region to do very similar things against Israel.
Mr. Netanyahu has said that the Houthis will pay a heavy price for this. What do you think he has in mind? What does Israel have in mind? Because I think back to July when there was that Israeli air attack on the port of Hodeida after a Houthi drone exploded over Tel Aviv.
I assume that it might be something which is similar in its scale. Maybe the Israeli Air Force will continue the destruction of Hodeida port, because not all the port was destructed in the Israeli retaliation in July. And maybe it will be another target, which is very valuable for the Houthis. But I assume that an Israeli retaliation will be.
Defense analyst Kobe Michael. The London-based Jewish Chronicle has understandably in recent months devoted a lot of coverage to Israel's conflict in Gaza. But some of that coverage, it turns out, hasn't been true. Four prominent columnists have resigned from the Chronicle after allegations that it printed articles about the conflict that were based on what the Israeli media have called wild fabrications. The paper has now deleted 9 articles by freelance journalist and former IDF soldier Elon Perry because of doubts over their accuracy and concerns that he'd also misrepresented his own CV. We approached some of the columnists who resigned, but they declined to be interviewed. So we turned instead to Alan Risbridger, editor of Prospect magazine and media analyst, as the host of the Media Confidential podcast. I asked him first about the paper.
I think it calls itself the oldest Jewish newspaper in the world. It's always been, I would say, until recently, a highly respected organ, a serious organ. And it has tried to reflect the broad range of feelings and aspirations of the Jewish community in Britain. I think it has great influence politically and probably internationally.
And can you give me any examples of these misleading or inaccurate articles that they have now deleted?
Well, they've started publishing articles based on supposed intelligence. One of them claimed that a Hamas leader was going to escape through a tunnel to Iran, and they were all based on anonymous sources. And these have been investigated by a website in Israel called 972, and everybody involved has come out and denounced these as works of complete fiction. So that obviously started raising questions about the author of these pieces, a man called Elon Perry. And it seems, on the basis of the Jewish Chronicle's own admission now, that these articles are completely not to be trusted.
So they were misled by a journalist who, as I understand it, had misrepresented his own CV.
He claims he was there at an Entebbe, the daring raid in 1976 in Uganda by special forces of Israel. These claims are all fantasy, and it obviously begs the question as to why a respected newspaper should have run a string of pieces, highly contentious and speculative pieces, on the word of somebody who they hadn't checked out.
Why do you think the Chronicle published these stories, if, as you suggest, they were a bit far-fetched?
Well, in recent times, and especially since October the 7th, the paper has been widely criticized for being edited by somebody who's accused of being an activist as much as a journalist. And I think they've slightly lost their way journalistically.
So the new ownership of the newspaper, you are saying, has affected its journalistic rigor?
Well, that's difficult to say because no one knows who the owner is. I can't think of a single instance in the history of the British press where a major and significant newspaper, we don't know who owns it. So what happened was that in 2020, the paper was struggling financially. And a consortium of the great and good, led by a BBC director called Sir Robbie Gibb, who had been Theresa May's spin doctor, suddenly appeared out of nowhere with the funds to buy the paper, pay off all its debts. And Robbie Gibb was named as the owner of the Jewish Chronicle, though he clearly hasn't got the money, that kind of money. So he appears to be the front man for someone, but it's never been revealed who the paper is owned by.
So, I mean, would you say the paper has moved to the right editorially?
Well, the critics of it, and that includes people who were involved in the purchase of it, say that it's become far too uncritical in its editorial tone and in its reporting of the Netanyahu government.
The resignation of a number of prominent columnists, a blow, would you say, to the newspaper's credibility?
It's a very serious blow. These are all very prominent journalists outside the Jewish press, all highly respected, and it deals at what, in my view, should be a near-fatal blow to the editorship of Jake Wallace-Simons, who's been very critical of the BBC for their reporting of the Middle East. And I think he was slow to wake up to the enormity of what had gone on under his own nose and didn't really take the complaints against it seriously.
Media analyst Alan Risbridger, and we approached the editor of the Jewish Chronicle, Jake Wallace-Simons, for a response, but he declined to comment. On Friday, the Jewish Chronicle said, "They deeply regret the chain of events that led to this point. We apologise to our loyal readers and have reviewed our internal processes so that this will not be repeated." You're with NewsHour, and Afro hair refers to the way in which black people and those of mixed race descent choose to naturally wear their hair, letting it grow perhaps, or using braiding, but those who do say they often face discrimination at school and at work. And here in the UK, on World Afro Day, campaigners are urging MPs to update equalities legislation to make Afro hair a protected characteristic, which they say could help to end discrimination. I spoke to broadcaster Sarah Jane Crawford, one of 100 black Britons lobbying Parliament, and I asked her about the types of discrimination that people face.
So when it comes to Afro hair, there's three main areas where we see discrimination come up. School, where from a very early age, Afro hair is deemed as unacceptable. It's not deemed professional. So the second area would be the workplace. So we have stats, and certainly Michelle De Leon, the founder of World Afro Day, has stats to support the fact that, particularly for women, if you're not wearing your hair straightened, then you're less likely to be hired or promoted. And then the third area of discrimination is the fact that because of almost like beauty standards, if you will, and because of the fact that the Eurocentric aesthetic is considered to be more professional, women are putting themselves at risk by trying to straighten their hair. We know that there's statistics around the fact that people who regularly relax their hair, which is using chemical straighteners, are more likely to develop things like reproductive cancers, endometriosis, fibroids, and things like that. So here are the three areas within which we're seeing discrimination: the educational institutions, the workplace, and of course, when it comes to health as well. In particular, black women are at a disadvantage because of the way in which they're trying to do their hair to kind of keep up with the standard that they believe to be deemed professional.
And you're convinced that a lot of this discrimination is a consequence of the way in which black women wear their hair rather than the colour of their skin?
Afro hair is synonymous with African heritage. So I just truly believe that when it comes to being a person of colour, particularly in a country where you are in the minority, there's lots of different ways, some of them obvious and some of them a bit more kind of like microaggressions, where you are told to be more Eurocentric, almost to be more white, basically. It could be in the way that you speak. It could be in the way that you dress. It could be in the way that you wear your hair. There's always different examples of you're not professional if you're too black. And I think that hair is just another extension of that. And that's the reason why it needs to be protected as a characteristic in the Equalities Act.
And what kind of response have you had from those MPs who you have contacted?
You know, really, really positive response. A lot of people may think, hair, this is so woke. What are we doing this for? But it is really important. This is the kind of thing that is linked to as far back as slavery, you know, deeming Afro hair to be not as desirable, to be inferior. And unfortunately, it's the reason why people are going to get held back, whether it's school or whether it's the workplace. And it also has a massive psychological impact on people when they feel like the way that they naturally present isn't good enough.
That was a broadcaster, Sarah Jane Crawford.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast, and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Julian Marshall. Cyclone Boris continues to batter much of Central and Eastern Europe with gale force winds, torrential rain and widespread flooding. Rivers have been transformed into raging torrents and large number of towns and villages are half submerged. At least five people have lost their lives in Romania and thousands of homes have been flooded. These residents of the village of Slobozia Konach spoke of the scale of the disaster.
It destroyed everything. I don't have anything left. The beds are filled with mud. The pillows are filled. I have nowhere to sleep.
We don't have food, water, clothes. The neighbor gave me a dress. It killed the dogs, the pigs. It killed all the chickens, all the grains. We have nothing left.
In Slovakia, a state of emergency has been declared in the capital Bratislava. Record wind speeds have been recorded in Austria, while in the Czech Republic, several people are reported missing as around 1,000 firefighters have been deployed to deal with the flooding and fallen trees. The Czech Prime Minister, Petr Fiala, urged people to be prepared for the worst.
It is a very serious situation, and we have to take into account that the worst is unfortunately not over yet. On one hand, the reports we are hearing are that 80% of the rainfall has already fallen. But no one must conclude from this that the worst is over. Unfortunately, it is not. Because now the levels of some rivers are yet to peak, and we are going to be faced with that very difficult situation during today and probably partly tomorrow.
Well, let's go now to Poland, where the Prime Minister Donald Tusk says he is to declare a state of natural disaster because of the flooding. I'm joined by the BBC's Sarah Rainsford. Sarah, whereabouts are you and what's happening there?
Yeah, I'm in Nysa in southwestern Poland, which is right at the heart of this disaster area, essentially. We've just come up to some higher ground now because the city centre here is completely flooded. The roads are impassable. And in fact, we were trying to make our way here. We took one turning and came across what I thought was the river, but it was actually just a regular street. And it was raging water. I mean, a real torrent of water crossing the main road. And right in the middle of all of that, there was a fire engine trapped and a truck, a military truck that had originally gone to help rescue the rescuers and had now got trapped itself. And we actually saw another military vehicle pulling up to try to rescue them. They had to pull away in the end. They couldn't do it. Ambulances couldn't get through. They were trying to get to the local hospital to evacuate patients from the emergency care department there because the hospital has flooded. But again, they couldn't make it through. So it is a really, really difficult situation here. This is a town called Nysa, but all the villages around, and many of them we couldn't even reach because they are so cut off by these flash floods, essentially. And as you were just hearing there in the introduction section, that the water is rising, and that is the danger, that the torrential rain has stopped, although more rain is forecast tomorrow. But the mountain water is still flooding down. A dam not far from here has apparently burst, been breached, and the water is expected to reach the towns around about here. So people are being told they really need to look at evacuating or at least making it to higher ground.
Sarah, many thanks. That was the BBC's Sarah Rainsford in Poland. We go now to another flood-stricken region of the world, Borno State in northeast Nigeria. Thousands of homes were engulfed in the state capital Maiduguri this week after a dam burst following several days of torrential rain. At one point, according to the state governor, half the city had been submerged with homes flooded and hundreds of thousands of people forced to seek refuge in camps for internally displaced people, or IDPs. There have been shortages of food and drinking water and fears of an outbreak of waterborne diseases. Carsten Noko is country director in Nigeria of the medical charity MSF, and he's currently in Maiduguri. What has been the impact of the flooding in the city?
The flooding has been yet another shock in a place that is quite precarious. We saw people basically living with a very small bag, with the very basic things that they could fit in a small bag as they were trying to escape the water and find higher ground. So the state government had set up 4 IDP camps the day after the flooding. By yesterday, there were 27 IDP camps. And this is where the majority of people have found space in. And yet there are still many other people who, for various reasons, either cannot make it to the IDP camps or decide not to go there for some reason or the other.
Drinking water, food, are aid agencies getting that to those who need it?
Yes, so there are efforts being made, but it is far from being enough, particularly when we think about the fact that we are still in the rainy season. We know that at this time of the year, we normally have cholera outbreaks, and so the floods basically increase the risk of cholera probably tenfold or a hundredfold. Because now, for sure, we do expect that in the next couple of weeks, these kinds of risks will emerge.
And I would imagine there's also a growing risk of malaria.
Yes, indeed. So in one of the clinics of Doctors Without Borders yesterday, we had consultation. So it's a pediatric clinic. And we, out of 120 children that were seen in this clinic, 90 of them were positive for malaria. So that's like 75%.
We've been talking specifically about Maiduguri, but I wondered whether aid agencies had been able to reach other parts of Borno State, which in the past has been a center for activity by Boko Haram Islamist insurgents.
As is explained by the authorities, so water basically moved from Alo Dam, which is a big dam just on the southeastern part of the city. And most of this water is still moving towards Lake Chad, and it will be a couple of days at least before it. So people are being affected as the water is moving. We do not have the possibility to reach many of these places because of the level of insecurity that has traditionally been in the areas outside of the main city of Maiduguri. So we are concerned about those areas, but we also today are not able to attempt to access them because of this level of insecurity.
That was Carson Noko, country director in Nigeria, the medical charity MSF, speaking from the northern city of Maiduguri. In India, there's been a new and potentially significant development in the case of a junior female doctor who was raped and murdered in Kolkata more than a month ago. Her body was found at the R.G. Carr Medical Center or college in the city, and her death triggered weeks of furious nationwide protests while junior doctors are continuing to demonstrate outside the regional health headquarters in Kolkata. A suspect was arrested for the rape and killing, and the principal, Sandeep Ghosh, was forced to resign. Now Mr. Ghosh has appeared in court on charges of destroying evidence linked to the rape and murder. He was already in custody, facing separate charges of financial irregularities. An officer in charge at the local police station has also appeared in court. Monideepa Banerjee is a journalist in Kolkata and a former executive editor at New Delhi TV.
The CBI, which is the equivalent of, say, the FBI, is yet to hold a formal sort of press interaction and tell us what the charges exactly are. But what we understand from sources within the CBI is that they have been basically arrested in this case because of conspiracy and attempts to destroy evidence of the crime. Now, specifically what those are a little hard to come by, but there are some obvious things that happened. One was that there was a destruction of a particular toilet next to the seminar room where the body was found. And it is believed that Dr. Sandeep Ghosh, the former principal of the college, he is the one who ordered it. And there's this other issue of CCTV footage that should have captured what was going on around the seminar room on the night of the 8th of August and on the 9th of August as well, early morning when the doctor is suspected to have been killed. But we understand that instead of hours of footage from CCTVs, the police has submitted only 27 minutes of footage and claimed to the court that the rest of the footage has glitches and are therefore not available for viewing.
But as you said to me, these details about Sandeep Ghosh destroying evidence are just speculation at the moment.
Well, in the documents filed in court today, the CBI has mentioned sections of the Indian Penal Code, or rather the new version of the Indian Penal Code that we have, citing exactly this, conspiracy to destroy evidence connected to the crime.
But the other details you've given me, the destruction of the toilet, for instance, and CCTV, these are things that people are simply speculating about at the moment.
Well, this is what we as journalists would say CBI sources are telling us. But yes, officially, it is largely speculation in the public space.
Will this add to suspicions that seem to be growing in India that there is more to this case than meets the eye.
I think that suspicion has indeed been growing from day one. And, you know, there seems to be an element of cover-up. When Sandeep Ghosh offered to resign, they transferred him to another equally prestigious medical college in the city, in Calcutta. So there are questions surfacing as to, you know, instead of punishing the gentleman, it seemed that he was being rewarded with another equally important post.
The protests, though, against the murder and rape of this young woman are continuing, are they, but perhaps with less of an intensity than they were in the immediate aftermath?
Today, huge protests are once again happening in the streets of the city, the biggest one perhaps by the doctors themselves. And there are many others, like teachers of that school are out on the streets marching. Then there's another school out in the district, far away from Kolkata, their alumni, they are marching on the streets. So it's a continuous thing that's going on in the city. Over the last 3 days, the government has tried to initiate talks with the junior doctors to end the deadlock. But somehow, after two very strong attempts to get the talks going, the talks have failed on both occasions. So the deadlock continues. In fact, positions are perhaps hardening, and this 36-day-old cease work by the junior doctors at the moment seems set to continue.
That was Monideepa Banerjee, freelance journalist in Kolkata. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall, and this is NewsHour. This is NewsHour, coming to you live from the BBC in London. The Emmys, awards handed out to the worldwide television industry, take place later today in Los Angeles, with the TV dramas Slow Horses, The Crown and Baby Reindeer among those nominated. The Scottish comedian Richard Gadd is up for 3 awards as the creator of Baby Reindeer, the controversial Netflix series about stalking. Our LA correspondent Emma Vardy managed to charm her way in to a decadent pre-show gathering.
Trust me, that's grandiose.
Take a 5-star rooftop in Beverly Hills, some famous faces, and you have the BAFTAs tea party. But no one's drinking much tea. It's the Emmys weekend and the champagne is flowing. At the warm-up, everyone's a winner. So who here's going to be walking away with a new piece of metal for their mantelpiece?
They're making moves.
Seems like everybody is.
Mark Duplass, who plays producer Chip Black in The Morning Show, a drama about US TV news, says he doesn't expect to win for Best Supporting Actor, but he hopes the women on the show triumph. 6 actresses are nominated from The Morning Show, including Reese Witherspoon and Jennifer Aniston.
She is a global icon, and the whole world wants something from her. And that should make her a very closed, difficult to be around person. She's still so open and loving and wonderful, not only just creatively when we're working together, but just personally.
Jackson Lamb, you're in charge of the rejects.
I don't like being called that.
What do you call them?
The rejects.
Spy series Slow Horses, starring Gary Oldman, has 9 nominations, including for Best Drama. Christopher Chung plays one of the misfit spies in the British drama.
What kind of reaction do you get to Slow Horses now? Because there's been a number of seasons, it's doing so, so well. The characters are so lovable. What do people say to you when you're out and about?
Do you know what? It's again, we've been doing the show for the last 4 years, and it's only now that I feel like it's starting to hit. It's really exciting coming to LA, coming to Hollywood, and having everybody know the show now. We came last year, and it was still kind of bubbling. So it's really satisfying. It's really quite exciting.
Perhaps now is the time.
The royal drama The Crown marks its final series with 18 nominations.
Really manly hands, haven't you? Chiseled jawline.
Should we run away together?
But it's the controversial Netflix series Baby Reindeer that really got people talking this year. The drama about obsessive stalking and sexual abuse became a massive hit when it was released. But the show, which claims to be a true story, is now the subject of a legal battle after audiences try to identify the characters they believe the show was based on. Richard Gadd is Baby Reindeer's star and creator.
When I wrote it, I think I really believed in it, and I believed that it would have success. Did I believe that it would be number one in like 82 countries and have the amount of discussion around it that it has had? Probably not.
The fallout from Baby Reindeer could have repercussions for the TV industry in future in terms of how it deals with drama and involves characters in real life. But right now, they're here to enjoy their success.
Our LA correspondent Emma Vardy reporting. The Lebanese writer Elias Houri has died in Beirut at the age of 76. He was born to a middle-class Greek Orthodox Christian family in Beirut. He joined the Palestinian nationalist group Fatah as a young man and took part in the Lebanese Civil War. He was wounded during the conflict, temporarily losing his eyesight. He went on to write over a dozen novels in Arabic, probably best known for his epic work, Gate of the Sun, described as the first true magnum opus of the Palestinian saga. Back in 2015, NewsHour's Lise Doucette asked him about the role of the writer.
Actually, I think the writer is a witness and a martyr. One of the elements of his survival is to search for life. This is what makes him a witness. But he is searching life inside death, which makes him a martyr.
And in searching for life, does that mean the writer also searches for hope?
I feel that I live beyond hopelessness. We are not in a hopeless situation. We are beyond hopelessness. If beyond hopelessness there is hope, then it's hope. But no, I prefer to use it. I think that the writer is searching to survive.
Well, I've been speaking to Fawaz Gyergis, Professor of International Relations at the London School of Economics and Political Science. How significant a political and cultural figure was Elias Houri in the Arab world?
Elias Houri was one of the leading and the most impactful Arab writer, a novelist, a thinker, an Arab public intellectual. He was also an activist. He participated in the Lebanese Civil War as a progressive leftist activist. He fully supported the Arab Spring uprisings in 2010, 2012. The Palestinian tragedy was one of the most important questions that animated the writings of Elias Houri, and of course his opposition to Arab political authoritarianism. I think to him, the Palestinian tragedy was not just about the Palestinians. It was a universal humanist question that affects all human beings. Sadly and tragically, Elias Houri died he was very embittered in the past few months. I follow his writings in Al-Quds Al-Arabi, a newspaper published in London. And he basically drew a link, an organic link, between what Israel was doing in Gaza and the deepening political authoritarianism, the implosion of the Lebanese society, and the implosion of the Arab political system. He really saw a kind of connection, a link, between the complicity of Arab regimes and the West with Israel's crimes and what has been happening in Arab societies in the past 40 or 50 years.
Will he be remembered as a literary or political figure, do you think, or are the two things inseparable in his case?
Well, I don't think you can separate the literary from the political writings of Elias Houri. I think most of his writings focus on questions of exile, on questions of identity, on questions of fragmented societies and identities. And his political writing focused mainly on the fragmentation and the implosion of the Arab political system.
That was Fawaz Gyergis reflecting on the life of Lebanese writer Elias Houri, who's died at the age of 76. And a quick recap, Donald Trump's campaign says the former U.S. president is safe after gunshots were fired in his vicinity in Florida. Local officials in Palm Beach say the shooting took place in the grounds of Mr. Trump's golf course while he was playing. A number of news agencies are quoting The FBI is saying that they're treating this as an apparent assassination attempt. That's it from this edition of NewsHour. From me, Julian Marshall, and the rest of the team in London, goodbye.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast, and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.